The views expressed on the Cystic Fibrosis Podcast are that of Jerry Cahill and his guests, and not necessarily those of the Boomer Esiason Foundation. Nothing in the Cystic Fibrosis Podcast should be considered medical advice. Such advice can only be given by a physician who is experienced with cystic fibrosis. The Boomer Esiason Foundation, Jerry Cahill, and his guests cannot be held responsible for any damage which may result from using the information on this podcast without the permission of your medical doctor. You're listening to the Cystic Fibrosis Podcast presented by the Boomer Esiason Foundation. Now, here is Jerry Cahill.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Jerry Cahill. I'm 49 years old with cystic fibrosis and living, breathing proof that people with CF can have a full life. Today I'm down at University of North Carolina Medical Center in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, for doctor's appointments and speaking to Lori McDonald, the transplant social worker at the phenomenal University of North Carolina CF Center and Transplant Center. Hi, Lori. How are you today?
Hi, fine, thanks.
Well, thanks for speaking with me. I've been juggling all my doctor's appointments, and then it's great to sit with you at the end of the day and do a little podcast. So I'm going to just kind of run through some questions, and if you have any questions, you can ask me also.
Okay.
First question I have is, how long have you been involved in social work?
I started social work back in 1988, I think, so it's been a while.
Okay. How'd you get involved?
Serendipitously. I just...
I like that word.
Yeah. I found an ad in the paper for a job at Mass General Hospital. And I didn't even have a degree in social work. And I took the job, and I loved it. And so then I decided to go get a master's degree, and hospital social work is what I've just loved ever since.
Wow, that's phenomenal. Now, did you, when you started out, where were you? Were you from Massachusetts, or?
No, I'm from North Carolina.
Okay.
Got transplanted up to Massachusetts.
Oh, transplanted, okay.
Yeah, and then... and worked there for quite a while, but I didn't do transplant social work till I moved back here about 5.5 years ago.
Right, I see. Okay. And what made you get involved with the transplant end of social work, or how did that come about?
I decided I wanted to work at this hospital when I moved back here, and there were a couple jobs open when I came to interview, and transplant was one, and I've forgotten what the other one was, but I remember having talked to the interviewer about the two jobs and just thinking, wow, this transplant information sounds so interesting. And the other job, I just let him know I just wasn't nearly as interested in. So luckily, I got the one I wanted, and it's been a great experience.
Wow. That's pretty amazing when you think of it. I mean, so before that, you had no exposure really to transplant?
No. I had done a lot of medical social work, mostly with elderly people, a lot of nursing home placements and adjustment to hospice care and that sort of thing. But I hadn't really worked with young people, and I had done no transplant work.
It's been a little scary at first, huh? I would think anyway.
I wasn't scared. I was just interested.
Yeah.
There was so much to learn. The variety is great, and I have learned so much from my patients.
Right.
You know, I learned a lot from staff people. I followed the previous social worker around for 3 days, and I was a sponge and learned everything I could from him. But I have learned so much from my patients here.
That's great.
And continue to.
Tell me, Lori, what does your job consist of, being a social worker for a transplant? Let me just one other part of that. You do transplant? Do you do lungs, heart, kidney, liver, or is it just lungs? Or you do all of it?
Oh,
wow.
I do all of heart and lung transplant. I do pediatric liver and kidney transplant. I do living donors. And right now, I'm covering for everything. So
that's a lot.
Yeah, it is. It's a little overwhelming at times, honestly.
And what does your job consist of? We can focus more here, because I don't know if we have the time to go into every area, but it's probably similar. What does it consist of when you're dealing with somebody that's being listed for a lung transplant?
It starts either with the evaluation or right before, when somebody's getting ready to come here and needs help with just logistics, because a lot of people with lung transplants come from pretty far away to this center.
Right.
So sometimes they need to find out, you know, where to stay and how to get here, and is there public transportation from the airport? No. You know, that sort of thing. But then usually where it starts is with the evaluation. And I do a pretty in-depth evaluation with everybody about what their background is, what they know, what questions they have, what supports they have, what their compliance is like.
And that's prior to them moving here, I would assume?
Mm-hmm, prior to them. It's the whole multidisciplinary team evaluating them for transplant. Okay. So I'm looking at psychosocial issues to see if somebody's going to be a good candidate from that point of view.
I see. Okay. So then they move down here, and I'm assuming then that you help them with kind of the move or trying to find a place to live if they're moving from far away, or give them some suggestions. Or
I give them information. I don't actually make any of the arrangements because people are interested in such a wide variety of different options, and people have different financial resources, and I like to point them in the right direction, but then let them go look at places and see what they like and what's going to feel comfortable to them.
Okay. And I don't know if you have this statistic or you can even share it, but what percentage of lung transplants that are done at UNC Medical Center do people have CF? Is it a large percentage?
The statistic I've heard is about 50%.
50%,
wow. Yeah, it's a big percentage.
That is big.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, I mean, this is a top-rated center, that this is the only center, I believe, nationally that will do a transplant if somebody has sepatia.
Right.
That is correct.
Right, and I believe Toronto does it in Canada.
Okay.
I've heard there's somewhere in Ireland maybe or in
right.
England that
But in the
does.
United
but
States,
in the US,
it's just
we're the
UNC.
Only one that I know of. Yeah.
Right. That's great. Okay. Next, I'm just curious. What are the challenges that you face in working with transplantation as a social worker? I mean, it must be very consuming, emotionally draining. I mean, what are some of the issues that you face?
I think financial issues are one of the biggest ones. It takes a lot to move here from far away, and most of our patients do have to do that with CF. And to not know how long they're going to be here, to have to afford a house here and the place back home to go back to, and helping people to sort through all of that, because there aren't a whole lot of options, and it's really important for people to do fundraising, but it's really hard for a lot of people to do it from an emotional and a practical point of view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is true. I mean, I actually got involved in some fundraising through the National Transplant Assistance Fund, but it's amazing. It's a very overwhelming thing, mm-hmm. for you. It's almost like you feel like you're kind of begging for money, but I mean, there's money out there that people are willing to donate and do fundraising, but that must be a very big issue. I mean, moving down, is there a certain prerequisite or requirement that if somebody is listed and everything is approved financially with their insurance, what normally do people need to move? Is there a certain, because a lot of the insurance won't pay for that.
Every insurance is different. So some people have a transportation and lodging benefit, but that's usually capped at $10,000 if they have it at all, and that doesn't last that long.
Right.
So now that the new lung allocation system is up and running, it's a little bit easier for us, I think, to tell people when it's time to move, because we know what their scores are, and we still don't know when they're going to be offered lungs, but we want them to come down around the time that they might be offered lungs.
Right.
And to get involved in our pulmonary rehab and our support group and, you know, our clinic and all that sort of thing. But, you know, people have come here and been transplanted a couple days later, and people have come here and waited for over a year.
Wow.
So you never know on the front end what it's going to be. On the back end, you pretty much know it's going to be about 3 months.
After post-transplant,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And if there are major complications, it can certainly be longer, but usually 3 months, and then people meet their goals and are ready to go back home.
Okay. What area of your job takes up the most time with patients, would you say?
The assessment process is pretty intensive. It takes a while to do that assessment, to sort of think it through and write it up and to share with the team. We sit down as a team once a week and go over all the candidates and you know, what our feelings are about people's
so
eligibility.
You've got this whole team approach, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we may have answered this question already, but what are the biggest issues that your transplant patients face? I mean, it's probably different for each patient, but
right.
What would you say are some of the biggest issues? pre-transplant and then post? Mm-hmm.
Pre-transplant, we've already talked about the move. That's just incredibly difficult, to rip yourself out of your own social support network and community and come to a place where you've probably not known anybody and have to get yourself established during one of the hardest parts of your life. So that's certainly a big one. But I think the biggest thing that people have to deal with is the weight.
The weight.
Yeah, they're feeling badly. They're anxious for transplant. They're worried about it, but they're also extremely hopeful about it. And they don't know when it's going to come. And a lot of people get really worried about whether they're going to make it long enough.
Right.
And it's just so stressful on patients and families to have this wait and not know when it's going to end.
Mm-hmm. Now, also talking about the move pre-transplant, you know, there is requirements for that. Is that a family member? How does it normally work? Is it a family member? The whole family moves? I mean, it varies, but that is a requirement, correct?
It's a
you just can't come down here by yourself.
Mm-hmm, right. You've got to have a caregiver.
Okay.
And you can have a patchwork. You know, sometimes, particularly post-transplant, people will have different people come, a little tag team, and somebody will fly in for a couple weeks, and then somebody else will come and relieve them. And that's fine. We don't require that it's one person the whole time. But that's actually what I generally see. There's
okay.
usually one person, usually a family member, a parent or a spouse, who will just come and do it the whole time.
Right. Now, post-transplant, what are some of the main issues or biggest issues that you see with some of the patients that have been transplanted?
If things go well, I tend to not see people too much afterwards, and that's wonderful. When I do see people a lot, well, I see everybody for 3 months post-transplant because I run a support group and it's required pre- and post-transplant. But after those 3 months, when people have graduated and gone on home and gone back to their lives, if things are going well, I don't see much. But there's pretty much a guarantee that there's going to be some complications.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes we'll see people back in the hospital with an infection or with some sort of complication, and helping them through that. It can be a huge disappointment, especially if things have gone really well initially and people feel like, oh, this is great, you know,
yeah.
and then they get a setback. That can be really hard for them to mm-hmm. tolerate. So there's a lot of emotional support around that sort of thing.
Okay. And you mentioned support groups. Could you tell me a little bit about the support groups that you have?
Yeah, I run a support group every other Wednesday night, and it's an education and support group. So sometimes I have speakers, and sometimes it's open discussion. For example, last night we had nurses from infection control come and talk about, specifically targeting CF, about measures to try to prevent transmission of Pseudomonas or Cepatia from one patient to another, and talking about what hospital staff should do, what patients and families should do as well.
Right.
So I have speakers on just a wide range of topics. I have doctors come in, nurses, physical therapists, disability specialists, you know, all sorts of people. And I ask people in the group, what do you want to know more about? And so they give me great input about where they feel they're lacking. And so it's a neat opportunity to get more prepared intellectually for this and also psychologically by being with other people who are going through something similar.
Now, and this is for people pre, and then people once they're transplanted, they still come back to the group for a little bit while
right.
they're in the hospital
right.
or while they're living here for the 3 or 4 months?
Exactly. And people are always welcome to come pre or post whenever they want, but it is required from the point where we think you're close to getting a transplant till 3 months afterwards.
Wow, that must be pretty exciting for people that are like in the group, and then somebody gets transplanted and
yeah.
then they come back and they can talk about it a little bit.
Yeah.
People must really like that because then they see it happens. Then.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And there's a tradition in the group that people will come back after the transplant and tell their story. Sometimes people bring pictures. They often will give a disposable camera to the surgeons and get pictures in surgery and come
oh,
back
really?
With the pictures.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, sometimes they save their staples and put them in a scrapbook and, you know, they've got all this stuff to show. And it's really neat because people who have been through it will tell you something really different from what the medical team will tell you because the medical team just doesn't know some
yeah.
of that stuff.
Wow, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's a neat experience.
Yeah, that's great. as a social worker, you know, we're talking about the biggest issues or needs that people have. In dealing with the patients, what do you find is their biggest question to you or concern, or what do they have? I mean, what do they speak to you the most about?
Where am I on the list? When am I going to get a transplant? That's what I hear the most. I spend a lot of time explaining how the list works and that nobody's really at the top of the list and, you know, that sort of thing. And then, you know, I mentioned the financial aspects before. When it drags on, there's a lot of coming
That's
back to
stressful.
Me about how am I going to deal with this? You know, what can I do now to be able to afford this?
Yeah. And what about the family members? What are their concerns, pre and post? I mean, I've heard sometimes that it's pretty, you know, horrifying, even though they're told or they're prepared for it, is once somebody's transplanted and they come out of surgery, they're like, you know, all the trees of IVs and whatnot. It's very difficult for family members from that end, and then I'm sure they must be, obviously it's stressful for them if they're moving down here also, because of their job situation, income, and I mean, that it's got to be a whole whirlwind.
It's hard. We try a lot in support group and you know, in other places, clinic and stuff, to prepare people for what it's going to be like right afterwards. And you're right, it can be quite shocking to see somebody after they've come out of surgery. It's like a spaghetti bowl of IV lines and wires and things. But also people can be extremely swollen because of all the fluid they get during surgery, so they can look quite different initially. And that can be scary, and that can be a real big adjustment that I help people sit through and understand.
Okay.
After that...
Now, do family members also go to the support groups, or is it just... Oh, they do. Okay,
yes,
that's great.
They are welcome to
So that prepares
friends.
Them a lot also.
Right.
Okay, good.
Yeah. I just lost my train of thought. There was something I was going to say, but after
transplants, family members, and dealing with some financial things, and just seeing somebody come out.
Oh, I know what I was going to say. Thank you. So afterwards, one of the really big deals that family members and patients have to deal with is they're changing roles. A lot of times, you know, just prior to transplant, people are pretty darn sick, and they can be pretty dependent. And especially if the patient is adolescent or, you know, sort of early 20s, in some cases they haven't been able to do that sort of separation that most kids would do at that age because they've been so dependent on a family member. And so the relationship, especially between parents and kids, can really be thrown up into the air with transplant. Somebody comes out and they're feeling great and they've got energy and they don't need a caretaker anymore. You know, they're going to need a chauffeur for 6 to 8 weeks because they can't drive because of the pain medicines and the incision and stuff. But they're not necessarily going to need the same amount of care that they did before. And as much as sometimes parents feel like they're going to be grateful for being off duty, it's also a huge loss because they suddenly aren't needed in that way anymore. And adjusting to that role change is really tricky.
Yeah, that's interesting that you bring that up, because I was talking to somebody, you know, a few months ago. It was a similar situation. They were transplanted, and it's amazing. They were talking about how their life had changed with their relationships with their family, and you know, whether it's a husband or a wife, how it changed, because sometimes, you know, people love to take care of people, and that was their role prior to the transplant. And then after the transplant, this person was a lot more independent and was out there, and it was a very, very big struggle on the relationship.
Right, and sometimes marriages fail because they can't negotiate all these changes.
Right. Actually, this one did because of that. Mm-hmm. It was they had to separate.
Yeah.
So, but you know, life got to go on, and got new lungs. So, but anyway.
Yeah.
Here's a good question for you. What lessons have you learned and gained from working with transplant patients that has been helpful in your journey through life? I mean, when we just started, you said that, you know, you really had no background in transplants, and it sounded very interesting to you. And I'm sure that a lot of these patients have made a difference in your life.
Oh, absolutely. And immediately the lesson that comes to my mind is to appreciate every day and live life to its fullest. I learned that over and over again from my patients, and I'm grateful for that lesson.
That's great. That's really important. You know, it's funny because, yeah, I mean, I have CF and I'm listed for a transplant. And I just try to, you know, enjoy my life and mm-hmm. do things. And it's funny how, like, you know, out there and living every day, you can see how people just get so crazy about things or, you know, don't value things and just kind of almost abusive to themselves. Mm-hmm. And, like, I look at some people sometimes and say, my God, if I had your health, you know, what I could have, should have, and, you know, would right. do. But it's so important. It's a great lesson to learn. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. you know, you're learning it in a situation that it's a very difficult. I mean, right. people getting transplants, you know, hopefully everybody makes it through, but it's not obviously an easy surgery.
Right. One thing, though, that really strikes me about CF patients in particular is the incredible strength of character. You know, I think I work with, as you mentioned before, so many other organ transplants, and a lot of the people who have transplants have acquired some illness later in life, sometimes because of lifestyle, sometimes just, you know, coincidentally. And people with CF, for the most part, have known that they've had it from birth. I've had a few people diagnosed as adults, but that's more rare. And, you know, I really don't see most of my CF patients being angry at the world or feeling like something's owed to them. You know, I see most of them making the most of every day and wanting to be just like everybody else, and some of them not even telling friends what they've got because they just want to go out and live the best life that they can. And that strength is just so inspiring to me.
That's great. It's really funny you bring that up because for so many years, I didn't tell anybody. I used to say, oh, I got a cough, I got, you know, asthma or something. And it's funny you talk about the strength because in New York, I have to go to support groups also.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that support group is a lung transplant support group. And what's interesting about it is that people there that have emphysema, it's not just cystic fibrosis, emphysema mm-hmm. and COPD and all of the spectrum of reasons why you would need a lung transplant, whether it's single or double. And it's amazing how people there that don't have CF, they sweat all the small stuff.
Right.
Like, I've sat there in meetings and people start to freak out. And again, I guess with CF, you're just, you were brought up that way. You take lots of pills and
right.
you got to do all these things and you're very disciplined.
Right.
The people there that were on the transplant list, their biggest concern and stress was, oh my God, I have to take 20 pills a day, and how do I do that,
yeah.
and how do I remember that?
Yeah.
And I remember one support group that I was there, and I just was listening to this, and from more than one person, I finally turned up, and I think the social worker kind of liked it, but I kind of shocked everybody. I said, then why are you on a transplant list?
Right.
Don't even be on the list. You're concerned about taking pills when you're going to get an opportunity for another life?
Mm-hmm.
But it's amazing, like, this is how some people think. It's
yeah.
it's crazy.
Yeah. You just reminded me of another thing that always impresses me about people with CF, in contrast to some of my other patients, which is it's such a well-educated group of people, self-educated. You know, most of my patients with CF have read everything they can get their hands on. They know their body better than anybody else. They know what they need and when they need it. And they have incredible questions to ask. They are just so involved in
yeah.
the process. You know, they are such an integral part of the team. They're not people who sit back and say, okay, do this to me. You know,
right.
let's do this with me.
And I would think that probably with a transplant, in most cases, helps them get through it a lot easier.
I think so.
Yeah.
Because they know what they need. They come in with... I think most people are prepared for the worst and hoping for the best, and that's the best position you can be in to go into it.
Right.
And they know what the risks are. They know what they want to get out of it. They know what's going to be expected of them later. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they just do what needs to be done. They're really hardworking people, you know.
Full speed ahead, right?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Well, let me ask you, what do you hope your patients and the family will remember most about working with you?
That I cared and that I tried to help them however I could.
Well, I'm sure you're doing a great job at that. I mean, from what I've known of you, I've known you probably 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's amazing kind of the work that you do here, I think. And,
thanks.
You know, just the you know, even bringing people to the Boomer Esiason Foundation mm-hmm. for transplant grants and whatnot. And mm-hmm. it's important because I'll tell you, there's lot of transplant centers out there where the social workers, and I don't, not to name names because I don't know, but they're not mm-hmm. as involved and, you know, trying to make a difference in people that are being transplanted and, you know, get them a grant. It's mm-hmm. so important. any advice or comments that you would like to share or give to people that are have CF or are listed for a transplant, you know, that could be in centers throughout the world?
Mm-hmm.
What advice would you give or comments do you have? Anything in particular?
Some of it is a synopsis of what we've already said. One is, you know, don't count on transplant as the thing to turn your life around. Keep living every day. Enjoy every minute of it, even on the bad days. Find something to enjoy. Prepare yourself as best you can. Learn everything you can. Exercise. Take good care of yourself, because you're going to be your own best advocate. And prepare yourself financially, too, because there are always expenses with transplant that are not covered by insurance, no matter how good your insurance is. And the last thing you want to worry about is the money when you're trying to deal with these life and death situations. So really plan ahead and try to get a fundraising team together, get some money in the bank, give yourself that peace of mind so that you can focus on more important things.
So you think it's really important, I mean, obviously it is important, but to get the fundraising going pretty quickly.
Absolutely. I mean, unless you're independently wealthy, and I
right.
know a few people are, but most people are going to really struggle to meet all of these costs if they're having to move away to do this. If they live locally, it's not as big of a deal. But the drug costs are always going to be a big deal unless you've got really good prescription coverage. And one thing that I think people don't think about a lot when they go into transplant, when they've been disabled, especially for a long time first, is that they may not be disabled anymore afterwards.
Right.
And they can't rely on Medicare and Medicaid to be there for them all the time, because if they, you know, they're never going to be cured, but they can get to the point where they can live incredibly full and productive lives and go back to school and all of that, and they need a safety net there for their medical bills, for going from disability insurance to going to, you know, insurance in the workplace,
right,
until they get a job that's not going to exclude their pre-existing condition or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And if they plan for that, then they're going to be more free to go out and do whatever they want to do, instead of worried that, oh my God, if I go out and do this work, what if I lose my Medicare or what if I lose my Medicaid? That holds people back in a way that doesn't allow them to live their lives fully, and I hate to see that.
Right, and that's a good point, because if people are so used to, whether it's a year, 5 years, 10 years of being on disability,
mm-hmm.
once you have a transplant, I mean, you're not cured, but your life, your quality of life should skyrocket.
Yeah, I know lots of people who are working full-time, in school full-time. You know, it's not for everybody, because some people end up having complications that they, you know, will have reactions to the drugs that don't make them feel so great all the time, or will end up with infections or whatever. So not everybody can go full steam ahead, but a lot of people can and should, because studies have shown that people who go back to work after transplant do much better than people who don't.
Okay, that's a good point. Okay. Well, Laura, do you have any questions for me?
I'm curious about how you got involved with Boomer Esiason.
Well, how I got involved is basically it started about a year and a half ago where, you know, I was at the time I was still working full time and I was on the transplant list and they had mentioned to start doing some fundraising. So I had started doing some fundraising. And basically my brother, one of my brothers, my sister, and some friends of mine really did most of the fundraising stuff because I was like kind of clueless about it, and I really was, it was, to me it was, I felt kind of like this is begging, this is crazy.
Yeah.
And just as a segue or getting into that, I remember my brother was doing the first fundraising event, and it was in my old high school, and he's talking about it. And I was like, oh, okay, that's great, that's great. And he's like, well, why are you talking about like you're not involved in it? So I said, well, you don't expect me to come to this event, do you? And he was like, Jerry, it's for you. You've right. got to come.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, my God. I mean, it was just, but it was amazing to see the outpour of love and whatnot for people there to support you. And it's amazing, and this is really important for people out there that need to do fundraising and get involved. So many people want to help out. They want to get involved.
You're right.
I mean, I was amazed at some of my friends I haven't seen in years mm-hmm. that they were just so involved, and I was like, wow. Yeah. It was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So anyway, with that said, then I did another fundraising event in New York, and a couple of people that were on the board at the Boomer Esiason Foundation were there because they were members of this athletic club.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they had mentioned that, you know, it would be great for me to meet Boomer because I was, you know, doing pretty well, you know, at the time. Still am doing, you know, pretty well considering that, you know, with cystic fibrosis and whatnot. So I ended up meeting Boomer, and, you know, he said, listen, if, you know, whenever you want to help out or volunteer, and I think I volunteered at one event, and it was great. And then I started to get sicker, so I had to stop working.
Mm-hmm.
So once I stopped working, you know, I called them up and to see if I could do some stuff at home, you know, on the computer. And, you know, so I volunteer there maybe 3 hours a week. And it's been great. I mean, I get to do a lot of work on the computer. And, mm-hmm. you know, with the internet these days, it's pretty amazing what you can do. And
yeah.
I'm involved with a lot of people with CF and talking to them, you know, on the computer, instant messaging, email, so on and so forth. And I've been helping out at the foundation working on transplant grants mm-hmm. for similar to things that we're talking about now when people need to move, you know, from whether it's New York or California down to, you know, UNC Chapel Hill for a transplant. It's very costly.
Mm-hmm.
So we work on giving out grants at the foundation to help pay for those moves. Or, you know, one other young lady was had to get a transplant, and she wanted to keep in touch with all of her friends, and she needed a laptop. So we were able to work something out
yeah.
to get her a laptop. So while she was, when she made the move, while she was waiting for the transplant, and then in the hospital, she was able to be online with all her friends, which was a great support system for her.
Yeah.
So I got involved in that, and I do some volunteer work for the transplant grants, and also for scholarships that we give out, scholarships for people with CF that are, you know, excelling and doing well in school and moving on, whether it's, you know, high school, college, or graduate work. So, you know, once you stop working, you know, because I was getting sick all the time, and every time I turned around, I was on IV antibiotics. I wasn't the type just to sit home,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, I do a lot of therapy. My therapies every day probably take, you know, 5-6 hours. And if I'm on IVs, you know, add another, you know, 4 or 5 hours. I just got off IVs. I was doing the calculations because I like to do the math. I mean, out of the day alone, I was on IVs 7 hours.
Yeah.
And then you add your aerosols in there. You add your, you know, your physical therapy.
That's more,
you know, it's a full-time job.
Yeah.
So. But it's good, though, because when you're doing, I mean, it's good that I've been able to do some volunteer work because, mm-hmm. you know, when I'm at home doing all these therapies, I could be on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I couldn't be doing that in my job. I mean, how could right. I be running around with IV poles and whatnot? It's just not a possibility.
Right.
So it gives me affords me the opportunity to be able to give back to the community,
mm-hmm.
to be involved. And let me tell you, over the past, you know, year, that I, you know, as much as I thought I knew about CF and transplant, I've learned so much from other people
mm-hmm.
out there with CF, people that are pre-transplant and post-transplant.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it kind of goes both ways. They've learned a lot from me. I mean,
sure.
I can tell you, I've had arguments with people on the phone about doing some exercise and, you know, one thing with CF, you talk about your FEVs, and one person was telling me once, oh, my FEVs used to be 80% and now they're at 65 and I can't exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And I got onto this whole heated discussion with this gentleman that mine are at 43, which is not great, mm-hmm. And 65 is a lot better, and that I still try to do exercise using a little oxygen tank. So again, it was a lot of give and take, so it's been a good experience for me in doing that, and you know, it's been very educational.
Yeah.
So I've enjoyed it.
Good. I appreciate so much what your foundation has done for my patients, because several people here have gotten grants from you, and they've been, you know, here longer than they expected, really having a tough time. Some of them sort of at the end of their rope when your grant came through, and it's been really wonderful.
Well, that's great. We appreciate your feedback, and yeah, just, you know, keep them coming. I mean, you know, the foundation is there to support people with CF and, mm-hmm. you know, people that are, you know, going through transplant. I mean, it's a very difficult thing.
It is, and they need all the support they can get from all of us.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, Lori, I'd like to thank you and the University of North Carolina Medical Center and the whole transplant team for taking the time today to speak to me. And, you know, I look forward to getting more applications and grants in from you.
All right.
And for more information on the Boomer Esiason Foundation, you can go to the website at www.esiason.org. This is Jerry Cahill. Excuse me. There's my cough. This is Jerry Cahill with Lori McDonald from UNC Medical Center saying goodbye, happy holidays, and remember, never give up on yourself and exercise for life. Thank you. Thanks, Lori.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
You've been listening to Jerry Cahill's Cystic Fibrosis Podcast. If you would like more information on cystic fibrosis or the Boomer Esiason Foundation, visit our website at www.esiason.org.